Okay, this hour we'll take your phone calls with Andrew Bashago right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. We'll take your phone calls with Andrew. Andrew, you were talking about Bill Clinton, and your father hit it right on the head, didn't he?
He certainly did. In fact, he mentioned it again. We were camping at Mount Shasta in the late 70s, and he asked my brother and I what the future would hold. And I think I said that that flying car featured in Star Wars would become dominant by the time I was an adult. And he said, well, boys, I can tell you this. One of our next future presidents is going to be Bill Clinton. And I really wasn't thinking about my project experiences as a youngster, even there in my late teens or mid-teens. And we found that statement so funny that we actually fell off the picnic table bench laughing at his statement that somebody named Bill Clinton was going to be president. But that, in fact, was sort of the strange culture we were living in there when I was, you know, sort of having these parallel experiences. I had a very wonderful and happy childhood growing up in New Jersey, but I had essentially been involved in, you know, the cult of intelligence at a very young age. And I think I repressed a lot of it, and so even by my mid or late teens, I was already not really connecting that kind of statement back to things I had heard when I was on the project as a 7, 8, 9-year-old. But I also might—I'd like to add also that I mentioned President Obama. That's a little bit stranger, and I think may even indicate that the hand of the Almighty in some way has been involved in furthering my truth campaign. I mentioned President Obama. Now, the strange thing about that is I met President Obama when I was an undergraduate at UCLA. I don't have the precise date, but we know it was either the spring or summer break of 1982 because I had interviewed Buckminster Fuller in fall of 81, and my meeting with the young Barack Obama occurred before he graduated from Columbia in summer of 83. I was having a discussion with a South African anti-apartheid activist on Bruin Walk, and I was sharing with him some of my thoughts in political economy, particularly the direction that the transnational corporations would be taking over the next several decades. And he said, listen, I have a house guest I'd like to introduce you to. I think he'd be fascinated by what you have to say about what Bucky Fuller shared with you and some of your ideas in political economy. And so I went with this individual over to his house in West Los Angeles. And I had a discussion that lasted about a half hour with a young student who was back in Los Angeles after having spent a year at Columbia. And he explained to me that his name was Barack Obama and that he was in L.A. Visiting his friends from his 2 years at Occidental College in Eagle Rock, California. Mm-hmm. And our discussion about the corporations, I was taking a much more radical take on where the corporations were going, the possibility that they might enslave humanity, destroy the environment. Barack Obama was taking a much more sort of liberal position that they were necessary institutions in society, a much more lawyerly analysis. And so our conversation unraveled essentially into an argument. And our host said to me, you better be nice to him, Andy, because he's going to be president of the United States someday. So the incredibly serendipitous thing is that as somebody, I mean, I'm sure that neither of them at the time understood that ultimately I would be able to make sense of that comment because I, in fact, had previously in my life been one of the children attached to the very classified defense-related research and development program where quantum access technologies were developed that would allow the U.S. government to identify a particular person of interest like a future president and literally approach them and brief them. But clearly, now Barack Obama was born in August of 61, myself in September of 61. We're literal contemporaries. And that meeting with President Obama occurred when we were 20 years old. So in the case of President Obama, he had 27 years to prepare psychologically for the presidency. I presume he must have been briefed by Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was his mentor at Columbia. Zbigniew Brzezinski had just served as national security advisor for President Carter.
He sure was.
But
and surely a globalist, Andy.
Yes, and I know I can date it to that time frame, so that indicates that after spending a year at Columbia, by that time, a young Barack Obama had already been approached by our government and at least informed about his destiny. You know, in a similar way, I was informed of my destiny as somebody who would be principally associated in society with the discovery of life on Mars, not simply because I was told that when I was a child attached to Project Pegasus, but I was shown and asked to read my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, that I published last year in 1971. I was shown the 2008 version and required to read it. And when I asked, well, why do I have to read this paper that I'm going to write, you know, 37 years from now, they said, so that when you do write it, it contains as much data about Mars as possible. So I think the significance of these experiences is that there was some attempt that was being made to take information from the future and use it in the present to channel certain outcomes that they either thought were beneficial for the country or that would help the people involved in carrying out very serious responsibilities on behalf of the country, like the president. But it is a pretty profound implication of my story, and it's true, and I think we have to do a lot of soul-searching and maybe even hold a national debate as a society. What are we going to do now about the presidency, now that we know that the presidents, in fact, have been given prior knowledge of their destinies as president? It's an incredibly complicated thing to resolve politically and philosophically.
Absolutely. Okay, to the phones we go. This hour will go by very quickly. East of the Rockies, Boston, Mass, we go. Hello, Lori. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Nice to speak with you and your guests. I have a question about the holographic film that your guest viewed on Jesus. And I know in another show it was mentioned that according to the police arrest report of Jesus was on the internet, and they give descriptions when they arrest someone, and he was listed as 4'8" and a hunchback. And I just wanted to know if this is true, or did he look, more like what they depict in photo, paintings of him, and things like that.
That's a fascinating question. The individual being crucified in the hologram, or actually it was a documentary, black and white documentary film of a hologram of somebody from that era being crucified. They had concluded it was Jesus of Nazareth. But, of course, there were something like 600 men of Jesus' time and age who, in fact, were executed in that way during the period when he was crucified. The individual in the film was very emaciated. He had black hair and a beard. He was essentially a European male with a sort of an aquiline nose and slightly droopy eyes. Not unlike, in fact, Sylvester Stallone's, but he was in a great deal of anguish as a result of dying in that manner. The reason I do believe it was Jesus of Nazareth is a number of things that occurred during the film were right out of the gospel accounts of the crucifixion of Jesus, including the Roman centurion Longinus leaping up actually on one foot, because the individual being crucified was on about 14 feet off the ground. And so Longinus took the end of his spear and actually speared the side of the individual being crucified. There were also women who were coming and praying at the foot of the cross. And so I'm not sharing this information to advocate a particular religious interpretation of the events, but the film I saw definitely closely followed the scriptural account of Jesus' crucifixion.
Okay, let's go to Springfield, Mass. First-time caller. Andy, go ahead. You're on with us.
Hi, I just have three questions. For the guest?
Three?
Cool.
let's go one at a time.
Okay. You say that there's time travel, so does that mean that there's, like, time cops for, like, maybe rogue agents that decide that they're going to go off and do other things?
All right. That's question one, Andy.
I have no knowledge of time cops, but I do know that in one of the seminars about teleportation, one of the reasons that the program gave for not introducing the technology socially was the concern that rogue elements, or in fact they mentioned organized criminal networks, would get hold of the technology and improve it, and in that way oppress society by, for example, committing crimes and then teleporting elsewhere to evade arrest. So certainly the issue of policing teleportation was within the contemplation of the program sponsors, but I don't remember the notion of time cops ever being articulated any further than that.
All right, number two, Andy.
Was Gene Roddenberry the creator of Star Trek from the future?
I don't know. I think one thing I can add to the discussion of science fiction is that it's a literary genre that was partially developed by the U.S. intelligence community and military to take information from real clandestine projects and place them in fictional accounts so that the public would either be confused about the nature of things like new technical developments that were being kept secret, or if somebody who had been an insider pointed to their to the technology or described their experiences, their accounts could be attributed to a fictional genre. So, for example, with Star Trek, they were revealing a teleportation technology right around the time that it, in fact, emerged in the defense technical community in the United States, but they were depicting a form of teleportation that was literally the opposite of the teleportation technology that had been developed. But I don't have any information suggesting that the brilliant Gene Roddenberry was anything more than a great creative mind from our own time.
And your last one, Andy?
Is there any way I can get involved?
Oh, now that's a good question, too. How does he get involved?
Well, my Mars research project is at www.projectmars.net. I would urge you to become a supporter and participant in Mars. And my truth campaign, Project Pegasus, is at www.projectpegasus.net. And so I would urge you to visit those websites and join my campaign. Also, I'm up on Facebook. We have two groups, one Project Pegasus and the other entitled The Discovery of Life on Mars on Facebook, and you can keep abreast of my truth campaign on those two sites on Facebook.
Okay, next up, we go to John in Sun City, California. You're up with us. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, other than maybe giving me some lotto numbers in the future, I have a question regarding needing Rumsfeld and Richardson to confirm what you were saying. Wouldn't it be simpler, since the chances of them doing so is very nil? Couldn't you write something down, since you know of these other things, like Clinton and Bush's being made president, your knowledge of some of the things in the future, in the near future, write it down, put it in a vault somewhere, like with George, and then unlock it in 6 months or a year, and say that these six or eight things that you said would happen 6 months earlier came true? Wouldn't that be proof enough that what you're saying is confirmation?
Well, this idea comes up, and I'm sort of asked to prove my claims by being a soothsayer. Let me just say this. My project experiences on Project Pegasus occurred 40 years ago when I was age 7 to 11. I'm now 48. I've spent the last 10 years investigating what happened to me and writing down as much as I can remember. Things like being able to correlate the one lunch in 1971 when both President Bush's were present and apparently had recently been briefed on their presidencies are just one episode in an entire lifetime that I've been able to go back and identify as having happened on the project as a result of doing literally 10 years worth of memory work. So I think that's a very logical question that you ask, but it's not a requirement that I'm going to impose on myself, because my account is really a memoir that I've recovered from the recesses of my own life experience 4 decades ago. And in fact, if I had not gone about the process of recovering the memories, that is to say, focusing on them for 10 years, I'm not sure I would have been able to correlate much of the information. I would have simply forgotten it and moved on with my career as a lawyer and as a writer. So I don't want to position myself as a soothsayer, because essentially I've been able to identify the things that were predicted about the future because they were referenced in discussions 40 years ago, and I've done the memory work to recover them. But I'm not prepared, for example, to say who the next president is going to be.
Can you say, Andy, whether we get hit by an asteroid or anything like that?
Well, there was catastrophic information that was revealed in one of the time probes. Let me describe it. I don't remember anything involving being struck by an object from space. But there was a very, very basically dangerous chronovisor probe that was undertaken on November 5th of 1971 at the ITT Defense Communications Facility in Nutley, New Jersey, which then and now is literally physically adjacent to the Defense Logistics Agency branch that's there in Nutley, New Jersey. And for that probe to the future, there was such a high-intensity light generated by the crystal array in the chronovisor that we actually had to wear a crystal helmet and a protective spacesuit-like suit, a garb, that was sputter-coated with titanium to literally physically protect us from the energy field that we were placed in. During that probe, we went forward for about a half hour to remotely view the status of the U.S. Supreme Court building as it would appear on the Mall in Washington, D.C. in the year 2013. And I do believe that year was selected because of the concern regarding the Mayan prophecy and what may befall us, on December 21st of 2012.
2012.
And what I saw during that probe and reported to the lieutenant commander from the Office of Naval Intelligence, who debriefed me when my clothing was removed on the stage, my boots were poured out, not, I believe, from water, but actually my own perspiration. It was so hot in that suit. I was taken down the hall, and the lieutenant commander from ONI asked me, okay, Andy, tell me about the target. The target is what we had been trained at some exercises at Curtis Wright to actually focus on and look quickly to the left and right when the forward momentum of this particular probe stopped. And essentially what this was that event as it was forming prior to the collapse of the wave function in that area of the quantum hologram where that future event on that timeline was stored but had not yet occurred from the perspective of our position in the time-space continuum. And what I saw and reported to the Office of Naval Intelligence is that the U.S. Supreme Court building was under about 100 feet of brackish water. In fact, there was algae growing on the stately columns in the front of that building. But I hasten to add that we can't use that information to be apprehensive about the idea that there will be a catastrophe in 2012 involving, let's say, substantial coastal flooding that would place Washington, D.C. underwater, because all of the chronovisor probes were to adjacent timelines in the multiverse. In fact, I think something significant about my investigation that I can offer to the discussion about time travel, both in science and parascience, is that Project Pegasus proved the existence of the multiverse, the notion that the quantum hologram consists of a multiple set of adjacent timelines that are essentially similar, but that differ slightly and are sort of densely packed, internested sets of timelines. Because when I was being sent multiple times to the assassination of President Lincoln, I had been trained to go through the lobby and up the stairs and behind his box there at Ford's Theater. Every time I was sent there, something different would happen. And then later in 1971, I was present at the meeting in the evening at the Sandia Auditorium where time travel to the past involving chronovision using children was shut down because in the words of the administrator who was announcing the termination of that part of the program, every time we send the same child or a different child to the same event, it changes a little bit. So when I described this probe to 2013, in which clearly there had been a mass disaster, in which presumably the entire eastern seaboard had been flooded with a substantial amount of water, God knows from what, global warming, maybe the collapse of La Palma in the Canary Islands into the Atlantic, perhaps a meteor strike in one of the world's oceans. I'm saying that that information had been detected on one timeline, but that doesn't mean that we're in the timeline where that event will occur.
You're very good, Andy. I got to tell you, it's a very compelling story. We'll be back in a moment with final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, Craig Hewlett joins us as we talk about some major issues of the day, and we'll take your phone calls as well. By the way, in the not-too-distant future, sooner than later, we will be having the Coast to Coast Instapoll on the coasttocoastam.com website. Immediate polling questions to you about specific issues of the show or questions of the day. For example, do you believe the swine flu was concocted in a laboratory? Yes or no? Through the Coast to Coast Instapoll, you'll be able to go there and say yes or no, and we'll get instant results, and we'll share them with you on the show. We'll even share them with guests who might be appropriate for that specific topic. So look for that in the not-too-distant future on the coasttocoastam.com website. And welcome back to Coast with Andre Bashago, the attorney, the author as well. Let's take some more of your calls. You ready for the final calls, Andy?
Yes, let's fire away.
Peter in Queens, New York. Go ahead, Peter.
Yes, I'd like to ask two front questions, one on Christ and the other one on DVD copies. On Christ, there have been various variations, like certain famous Catholic saints and mystics had different variations on how he really looked like. So did he look like the Holy Shroud, a Turan? What age was he? Did he have nails in his wrist or in his hands? The other question is, the great composers like Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, and Franz Liszt doing their own works, and Babe Ruth playing a nine-inning game in his prime in the 20s in a modern video, DVD, audio, a copy, and all that. These we wouldn't get variations because we know how these individuals look like. So that's the two questions I'd like to ask you.
Well, the individual I saw being crucified, who the project had concluded, was Jesus of Nazareth. I think the closest depiction of him would be perhaps the El Greco rendering of Jesus. This individual was very thin, had very dark hair, aquiline features, a very narrow face, droopy eyes.
How old was he?
He looked his age.
40 years old, as the modern scholars say. He was born 4 B.C. or 6 B.C. Would you say he's about 40 or 30 or 33?
He could have been. I couldn't really say whether he was anywhere from 33 to 40, but he was certainly in that age range.
And did he have nails in his wrist like the Holy Shroud predicts or traditional?
Yes. Well, the one thing that was conspicuous to a child who was growing up in the Roman Catholic tradition and seeing what was being purported to be the actual crucifixion of Jesus was that he wasn't on a cross. This individual was on a pole, and there was a very short cross piece that he had been nailed to through the wrists, maybe about a 3-foot cross beam on something that looked about the size of a modern telephone pole. And he was in a great deal of anguish, and that was quite disturbing to see. There was a crown of thorns. I mentioned the women who came to pray at the foot of his cross, and also the Roman centurion reaching up to lance him in the side. Let me just say, in reference to your question, he did not resemble the face in the shroud at all. That individual looks much more august and robust.
But remember what you said yourself and what the saints have said themselves. There are variations. I mean, there are different variations of him. And even the saints had different, you know, Sister Aida of Spain and Catherine Emmerich, that Mel Gibson had his Passion of Christ go by. They both had different variations of Christ. And like you had said earlier, going back in the past or whatever, there was different variations of certain events or certain scenes or whatever.
Right.
And Andy, don't you also think, though, that a 40-year-old of that era would look much older than a 40-year-old of this era?
Certainly. And this individual was very emaciated and was in a great deal of pain. I would say that he certainly looked like depictions of Jesus. I would say that the actor that was cast in the Mel Gibson production, that wasn't very far off, although he looked a little bit more Mediterranean than that, or Middle Eastern.
Was that James Cabiel? I don't know how he pronounced
it. Yeah, the individual in the documentary that I was watching, of ostensibly the actual crucifixion, was more swarthy looking, more of a Middle Eastern phenotype, very thin, as if he had been starving for weeks or even longer and suffering for a great deal of time before he was crucified. Regarding the caller's second question regarding the great individuals in the past, I think that's one of the positive potentials of Chronovision that undergirds my truth campaign regarding these quantum access technologies. Imagine being able to go into the National Archives in Washington, D.C., and seeing Bach perform or seeing the U.S. Constitution being signed. I mean, we can watch modern events that have been filmed, let's say Martin Luther King giving the I Have a Dream speech, and be profoundly moved. Imagine what would happen culturally if we could go to virtual museums and libraries where a protectorate that would be in control of the Chronovision technology so that it couldn't be abused to violate people's privacy, but that would uphold a high standard of quantum access and allow the public to view different significant and inspiring moments in history. I think that would culturally be a very profound resource. So in that sense, I think we should start thinking about using these quantum access technologies to spark a cultural renaissance in our global civilization as a result of going back and viewing inspiring moments from the past, not just in American history, but in all of world history.
How did you feel about your father allowing you to go through this program? Did you ever get upset with him, or were you happy about it?
Then and now, I feel like he permitted me to enjoy a profound cosmic privilege. Certainly one of the funny scenes in the movie is going to be the fact that there was a point where I had a little temper tantrum and I said to one of his friends in Albuquerque, he doesn't give me credit for anything. And in fact, he wasn't giving me credit for serving in a classified defense project where time travel was going on, and I was responsible for undertaking it. So we shared in a special way as father and son in the program. I think perhaps the abiding human or literary theme of my book is that we're all alive for only a brief moment in time. And the kind of interludes that I had with my father when we were serving together on Project Pegasus now have a very profound resonance with me. And I'm glad that we were able to essentially participate as father and son at the dawn of the time-space age. I view it as an incredible privilege that we had, not just as father and son, but simply as human individuals who were there at literally the inception of time travel and the time-space age. So I look back with great fondness and some sense of poignancy about the fact that my father is deceased and he can't share in this next phase of my life where I'm bringing public attention to the fact that these technologies were developed and that we should be trying to enhance their positive potential and prevent their negative potential. I think he'd be quite proud of me.
Let's go to Jennifer in Cincinnati, Ohio. Hi, Jennifer.
Yes, hello. Well, I have to ask, since we have had this technology for 40 years now, and we were able to develop it in the first place, I think common sense would say that if there are other intelligent species and civilizations out there, that they would come across this technology too. So did you meet any extraterrestrials in your time travels, and did they look human?
And that's a very complicated question. I'm going to go into some of this in the book. I had a set of contact experiences as a child with the Greys that I really don't think add a lot to the discussion about human ET contact. When I went and I plotted everything that happened in Pegasus, and then I examined where these episodes of extraterrestrial contact occurred, obviously I was examining whether my memories of having served in Project Pegasus resulted from extraterrestrial contact. I was trying to disprove that premise in the same way that I was controlling for other factors like fantasy, delusion, government mind control, mistake, and so forth. And what I ended up finding, and I think does add to the whole study of extraterrestrial or interdimensional human contact, is they seem to have been appearing as a result of the fact that I was appearing in the realm that they occupy, that they are operational in, which is the supraluminal realm of fourth and fifth dimension functioning. So I'm going to describe in the book, for example, one time I was moving forward in time in the Montauk chair. One of the quantum access technologies is the chair described in the Montauk Project books by Preston Nichols and Peter Moon, which is essentially a magnetic transducer that prompts an astral projection of a person's consciousness to subjective moments in their own personal futures. In other words, it works a form of psycho-spiritual time travel. And during one of those probes to my own future, the forward momentum stopped, and I looked to my right, and there were four gray extraterrestrials observing me, and then I continued to move forward. So I guess what I'm implying here or describing is that there seemed to be extraterrestrial or interdimensional monitoring of some of the time-space exploration activities that DARPA sent me on. And I think maybe that's a contribution to the whole discussion of who or what the extraterrestrials are and what realm of consciousness or reality they're actually functioning in. It's actually the higher time-space dimensions, I believe. I do not believe that they're necessarily biological creatures. I think they are, in fact, interdimensional creatures of a higher order.
All right, let's go to John in San Francisco. Hey, John, thanks for calling.
Oh, yeah. What an incredible program. I have a few questions. Hopefully I can get through them all real quick. George sort of touched on the first one. What did you feel about your father, you know, volunteering you for this project, top secret project, where he didn't know if you were going to come back alive or not? I mean, I find that hard to believe, that you share some kind of pride with that. The second question is, you mentioned that this teleportation can help our environmental or some other civilian problems that we're experiencing here on Earth. How exactly can this technology do that? Because you didn't go into details on that. And number three, if your story is true, why are you even allowed to talk about this? I mean, this is pretty heavy-duty stuff. Aren't you concerned for your safety?
Okay, let's take first.
Okay.
Well, during my 10 years investigating what happened to me in Project Pegasus, I was definitely concerned about my safety. In fact, in the summer of 2003, during my first fact-finding trip to New Mexico, a set of meetings were facilitated with different people. One of them was Governor Richardson. Another was Jack Pruitt, who had been one of the team leaders on Project Pegasus. A third individual I met with in the parking lot of, this was in June of 2003, of the Wolf Creek Pass Ski Lodge, which obviously was not being frequented because it was the middle of the summer and nobody was skiing. And during that meeting, I was essentially told by a representative of the Executive Office of the President, this would be George W. Bush's administration, the following. I was basically told that my memories of having been involved in Project Pegasus were valid, that the project involved black technologies that represented sensitive national security secrets, that I was admonished or being advised to cease and desist from investigating my experiences, talking about them, or writing about them, and then if I didn't do that, they couldn't, quote-unquote, guarantee my survival. So by that point into my investigation, I was literally being instructed by the executive branch to terminate my investigation. And I decided not to, primarily because I concluded that we really can't implement our destinies as individuals if we hold on to our fear of death. Achieving great purposes requires basically some form of fearlessness in the sense that you have to let go of worrying about the consequences of what you're doing. And so I resolved then to basically patronize them and tell them, sure, I'll shut up. But then I quietly continued my investigation. It's now gone on for an additional 6 years, during which I've recovered a lot more data. So, yes, I was actively concerned during my investigation that I might be assassinated as a result of investigating what happened to me and then later publishing this expose that goes into one of the more sensitive areas of national security activities, even implicating the U.S. presidency. Regarding your point about my dad, I think it might be helpful to go back and consider who he was. He had been a combat medic during World War II and had seen many children who had been killed in war. He had worked on the ramjet engine in the B-70 strategic bomber immediately after the July 1952 overflight of our nation's capital by, nine disc-shaped craft clocked at 7,000 miles per hour by Langley Air Force Base. So he was profoundly involved in classified aerospace projects that were being launched to protect the people of our planet from any potential threat that the extraterrestrials posed. So he had that degree of concern and involvement in protecting life on Earth, human life. I think it's clear also that he didn't volunteer me into the project. In fact, what happened was he was contacted at work by the U.S. Army and informed that I would be in the project. And that's actually one of the mysteries that I haven't been able to resolve in my investigation. In the final analysis, it remains a mystery as to why I was selected. We know that Admiral Rickover had launched a project called Project Talent in 1959 to identify young Americans who possessed either extraordinary intelligence, psychic ability, or leadership potential, and to cultivate their human abilities in these types of programs, even expose them to defense projects so they could later contribute to them after getting more education. So I think it's safer to identify the fact that I was more identified by Project Talent as somebody the government wanted to work with than I was volunteered into a classified defense project by my dad. It's also clear that at a certain stage, around 1967-68, when I was brought into the project, the U.S. government was already in possession of information about me pertaining to my Mars research. That is to say, I had already been identified as a person of interest, as somebody who, like Richard Hoagland and Mike Barra and all the great pioneers of Mars anomaly research that George has had on the show, that I too would play a part in contributing to that literature. So I think it's a very complicated profile. In fact, my father was approached. He didn't just say, well, let's use my son in this, just because he was one of the project engineers. And then regarding the environmental issue that you raise, this actually came up in a seminar that I took part in. You know, imagine Al Gore is studying with Roger Revelle about global warming at Harvard as an undergraduate at this time. I'm a child participant in Project Pegasus, and we're having a similar discussion. I remember saying during a seminar, well, if we use teleportation, we'll remove from the atmosphere all of those pollutants and particulates that are currently being put into the world's atmosphere by planes, trains, and automobiles. So the environmental significance of teleportation is that it'll allow us to obviate most of the pollution that is currently being contributed to the global atmosphere from transportation. And that's a significant component of the global warming equation. And so,
Andy, why did they call the project Pegasus?
Well, when we were told what the project descriptor was, you know, the project title, and it was explained how classified defense projects are given one name or the other, Project Manhattan, Project Zero, and so forth, Project Montauk. We were told that sometimes the naming was arbitrary, as in the case of Project Manhattan. In the case of Project Pegasus, we were told that the reason that Pegasus was selected is because the technologies would take us over the rainbow, that in the same way that Pegasus in Greek mythology, flew to the summit of Mount Olympus, these technologies would take us into non-ordinary experience, some of which would seem almost magical or fantastic. In its reach. And in fact, that is what happened. There were times when I was on Project Pegasus involved in these different forms of quantum access where I literally felt a zeal about what we were doing. I felt like a yo-yo on the end of a string. I had this deep sense of profound enjoyment and excitement about the fact that I was literally on the cutting edge of human experience. Other times, we were experiencing things that were quite terrifying. But I believe that they called the project Project Pegasus because a part of our experience on the project would be accessing non-ordinary realities that would be as magical as Pegasus flying to the summit of Mount Olympus.
Fascinating. Andy, give out your website, would you please?
Right. My Mars writings, and I'm really trying to create an international movement of research associates who will, as I have done in my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, show through works of natural history, through photo analysis and text, that Mars is an inhabited planet, and therefore we need to protect it from human beings from Earth. That work is currently up on the Internet. It's an evolving website at projectmars.net. And my cause to try to have the U.S. government declassify teleportation so that we can use it to advantage human beings around our planet is at a site that's just under development right now called projectpegasus.net.
And we will make sure we link all of those for you, Andy. We'll be back in a moment with Craig Hewlett on Coast to Coast AM. Well, we are getting overwhelming response to Andy Bashago, so much so, I'm going to keep him for the fourth hour. So we'll be back with your phone calls, and those of you who were on hold and hung up, try to get back on, but we'll take calls with you and Andy next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Andy, I have time traveled. I've gone into the future and yanked you back to the program. How are you?
Indeed. I had to teleport back to the phone, George.
Let me tell you something. The response is so overwhelming that I would not do justice to our listeners by only giving them an hour of phone calls with you. So we'll take advantage of this last hour. And Craig Hewlett was gracious enough, who just did a full show with me a week or so ago. We'll come back at a later date. But this entire project is incredible. Let's concentrate a little bit on Rumsfeld and Richardson. Rumsfeld, in my book, has created problems in Iraq and Afghanistan with aspartame and everything else. Tell me what you think his true involvement was with Project Pegasus.
Well, I know what his involvement was. He was the defense attaché. My father and I had substantial contact with Don Rumsfeld when we were on the project. He was well regarded. And in fact, he was at a phase in his career where he hadn't made all these controversial decisions. And so I think, to the extent that he's now a man in his mid-70s of advanced years, he has everything to gain historically by coming clean about this particular chapter in his career, so that teleportation can literally be unleashed to advantage humanity. I mean, he's had a very controversial career. But in those days, he was a 39-year-old former congressman who basically had been appointed to a board that President Nixon had established and yet was secretly serving on this time-space project. And so I think that
Secretary Rumsfeld will want to come forward to be responsible for this particular chapter in the history of our country, in which we acknowledge the fact that we developed this technology.
How will you try to get a hold of him or Bill Richardson to at least come clean?
I'm going to write them letters explaining why I think that the highest form of public service would be represented by embodied in coming forward now, and simply acknowledging that we developed teleportation. We kept it secret because, as Don Rumsfeld said in the talk that I was in that he gave a meet and greet in April of 71 at an underground amphitheater, sort of an intelligence committee briefing room, again in Cerrillos, New Mexico. And he described how the significance of the technology was to allow the military to put troops precisely where they were needed on the battlefield. Well, he's now lived another 30, 35, 40 years in that realm of focusing strictly on defense matters. And I think yet he possesses the intelligence to recognize the fact that teleportation could be so much more. It could be the way that we literally get from, you know, Grand Central Teleport in New York City to Union Teleport in Los Angeles in a couple seconds. So I think that he has everything to gain historically and personally by simply affirming the fact that we did develop this technology and it has great potential, and that potential was not implemented because the technology has remained weaponized since Tesla's death.
When was the last time that you teleported? How old were you?
Oh, God.
It's been years?
Well, let's see. In the summer of 1980, I had to teleport between a teleport near the Van Nuys Air Force Base in California, airfield, I should say, the Van Nuys Airport, and an area behind one of the labs in Los Alamos, because they found during my junior high school and high school years that I was quantum slipping. I was having experiences, let's say, where I was putting my books in my backpack in junior high school, and I could hear all the kids roughhousing behind me, you know, all the other junior high kids. And then suddenly I'd hear a ringing in my ears as the sound diminished, and I found myself standing there by my locker alone. So at some point between the time that I was marshaled out of Project Pegasus as an 11-year-old in 1972, and then we moved to Southern California, and my first year of college, the intelligence community, which obviously my father had remained in communication with, if not working for, determined that a quantum slipping was going on that needed to be corrected. And so they had me teleport from Van Nuys to Los Alamos and back to try to correct that. That had resulted from an episode at Sandia in 1971 when my father was supposed to get me through the teleport back to New Jersey by 9 p.m., but he became engrossed in a discussion with another engineer. He met in the hallway there, and I finally ended up jumping through the teleport at Sandia at 9:02 p.m. And I don't know what the basis in physics is for what happened, but I somehow... The witching hour was actually 9 p.m. I was supposed to have jumped through the device 2 minutes earlier, and that created some kind of technical problem that they were trying to correct. So that was the last time that I teleported, was in 1980. On Earth. But then in 1981, in the summer of 1981, they had placed the CIA agent in my life named Courtney M. Hunt. And the question that he was plying with me the entire summer of 1981, you know, June, early July of 81, is, do you want to go to Mars? And I said, quite frankly, no, I don't. And so I finally relented when he explained, well, you have to go to Mars because the survival of human life relies on it or depends on it. Yeah. And I think by that he meant that we have to possess the courage to go off planet. So in any case, I did 2 jumps to Mars via a jump room at a CIA facility in El Segundo, California in 1981. And I think that was as a result of both the intelligence community wanting to acclimate me to Mars because they knew what my destiny was relative to the discovery of life there, you know, the natural history work that I'm about right now, articulating what's up there, but also simply because I'd been one of the kids who had served on Project Pegasus. So I haven't, since 1980, I haven't done any of these teleportings around the country like I did as a child, but there were several one-off jumps to Mars in 1981, and I don't think we have time to get into that tonight, but that's part of why I'm speaking out now, which is to reveal the fact that we've been using teleportation to reach Mars, and I don't think we should move forward as a civilization keeping such activities secret from the majority of human beings on our planet.
Interesting. Paul Guercio, who heads up the Merlin Project, which is a computer software program that predicts and analyzes timelines for the future, says that one of his clients is former Secretary of Defense William Cohen under the Bill Clinton administration, wants to know if you want an entree there. If you do, let me know. And he said he'll work on it. So that would be Bill Clinton's Secretary of Defense, William Cohen. Can he help you at all?
Well, if he can, I would certainly like to talk to him. I think that's a very generous offer. But, yes, I want to work through positive people in the political life of our country simply to achieve the revelation of the teleportation capability. This is as significant. It was when Tesla developed it as significant as the achievement of air flight by the Wright brothers, as significant as the landing on the moon. And yet we kept it secret because a determination was made during World War II that this should be used as a weapon system. And it could be so much more than that. So if Secretary Cohen and other positive, progressive people in our political culture want to assist me in this effort, I would consider it a privilege to work with them to bring this to the attention of the American people.
All right, back to the phones we go. We'll pick it up by going to Jackie in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. You're up with us on Coast to Coast. Jackie, good morning.
Good morning. I would like to know if you see anything positive about the United States economy since China is becoming a little bit restless and they want to execute their lien on our U.S. Treasury.
Well, again, I've resolved not to become a prognosticator or soothsayer because the factual basis story is my 10-year investigation carried out roughly between age 38 and now 48 to go back and describe what happened 40 years ago. And so I'm not really in a position to make a set of predictions about coming events. I am an optimist, however, because I've been to the future and it's a beautiful place to visit. And so I think in the long haul, the world that our children and grandchildren will be living in will be a very nice place to inhabit. And so ultimately I'm an optimist. But I don't have the factual basis, in fact, to make near-term predictions like that, because what I overheard at the dinner table 40 years ago was very limited. In fact, they were keeping from the children in the program most of the knowledge about future events, for example, that were being summarized in the kinds of intelligence reports that Don Rumsfeld and my father and other principals on the project were promulgating.
Though it's probably a different show, give me a highlight on what you think is on Mars.
Well, my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, is an analysis of a single NASA image, image PIA-10214, which was taken from the western edge. It's a westward view from the western edge of the Home Plate Plateau in the Columbia Hills range of the Gusev crater of Mars. And what that shows is, as I described it in my paper, literally it's a cosmic treasure trove of humanoid beings, different animal species, very ornate carved statues, and some built structures that we found in that photograph and other photographs taken by both NASA and the European Space Agency. So we're really entering a new era here of Mars anomaly research, where the great foundation made by people like Richard Hoagland, Mike Barra, Graham Hancock, Robert Bovall, Carl Munk, and others is now being supplemented with data from the rovers, in which we're seeing that, in fact, Mars was not just inhabited in ancient times, as the satellite imagery has always suggested, but the rovers show, in fact, is an inhabited planet today. And that's fraught with implications and complications that we simply haven't even discussed as a global society here on Earth, much less resolved.
Okay, next up we go to Gerald in Dayton, Ohio. Hey, Gerald. Go ahead.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Hey, good talking to you guys. Hey, I had a dream the other night that there was a economic collapse, total collapse inside the U.S., and there was two different factions fighting. There was two different military groups, like generals, fighting it out inside the U.S. Is there any indication of this type of activity that you've seen?
No, there was no data that was derived from Project Pegasus that I either learned directly or heard about that indicated any future civil war scenario in the United States.
All righty. Thank you.
All right. Appreciate you being part of that program. Next up, we go to Temecula, California. First-time caller. Hello there. Go ahead.
Hi, George. This is my night. I got disconnected twice, and I was able to call in third time.
Not this time. Go ahead. You're all set.
Okay. So, George, I'd like to thank you for being a link in the chain, first off, and I was on the chat last night. And I have a question for you, Andrew, and thank you for being on the air tonight.
Thank you.
Are the teleportation hubs that you're talking about, are they located in a specific pattern around the Earth, like perhaps Buckminster Fuller's shape of the dodecahedron or something of that nature?
That question comes up quite a bit because of the information that we have about ley lines, that there's a natural geomagnetic grid around the surface of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that the teleports were located on either ley lines or intersections of ley lines, primarily because when Jack Pruitt trained us on the teleport at Curtis Wright, he explained that what Tesla had discovered was a way using hardware, basically using a device, to draw a form of energy that permeates the universe that he was calling radiant energy, that it had among its properties the capacity to bend the fabric of time-space. So I don't believe that the connection with ley lines was required because the device was able to propagate one of these portal tunnels wherever it was placed.
These portal tunnels, could they be rainbow tubes of light at any time?
Well, they were tubes of light. That's a pretty accurate description. But they were moving tubes of light. So as you were moving through the portal tunnel, the walls of the portal tunnel seemed to be moving behind you. And if you look to the side, you saw that all sorts of transparent images of different random events were occurring.
Oh, interesting. I had an experience in Machu Picchu where I was all of a sudden popped into space and I saw these planetary spheres. And first I was attracted to it by a screeching sound. And I turned to my right and all of a sudden, boom, I was in the solar system watching this sphere go by me. But the sound connected me from this world to the black deep space. And then I had another experience that same day later on. I was going through a rainbow tube of light, and I go, wow, I wonder if I could slow this down. But before I even thought that, each color was in my peripheral vision, slowing down one at a time. So it's interesting that, I went back into Cusco at the time, and it said, this is the rainbow tube of light. I mean, rainbow city of light, they called it on a poster.
Right. Well, there wasn't a rainbow pattern inside the tunnel. It was more of a blue-white luminous quality. I think it was distinguished by the fact that when you looked at the walls of the tunnel, you could see all of these holographic images of random events from different timelines rushing past you. The universe was actually being opened and moved past us. That's how it was explained to me. But I'm not a physicist, so I can't actually explain how it was being accomplished. But I will state the truth to the end of my days, which is that we were doing it.
Andy, whatever happened to the other youngsters who were part of the Pegasus program? Where are they now?
Well, I spoke to six or seven of them who were in my immediate group. The 140 American school kids who were brought into Project Pegasus were arrayed in 14 groups of 10 co-experiencers. And each of them had a team captain who received specialized training if a mishap occurred on the project. I had been selected as the captain of Blue Team. So, for example, when we jumped through the device in 1971 and found that we had accidentally arrived in 1991 in Santa Fe, and I had to summon help from Sandia, I kind of pulled rank and asserted my authority as captain of Blue Team, and we got home by somebody coming up from Sandy, and we jumped basically 20 years home. I was able to question those six or seven participants from my team at length, and what I found was very interesting. Everything that involved quantum access that had occurred inside the four corners of the learning lab that we were placed in, being placed in the Montauk chair, participating in remote viewing for the U.S. Navy, being spun to induce out-of-body experiences, and the kind of far-out things that were going just within the learning lab, all of the participants remembered that. But then when I began questioning them about things that had happened at the defense labs in New Jersey, like the probe to 2013 that we took part in up at ITT Defense, their memories were far more partial and fragmentary. And it was clear to me that they had been basically brainwashed to forget what happened. And in the book, I'm going to describe what some of these things that were done to us were done to basically prevent us or try to create a situation in which we wouldn't want to revisit our memories. There were some very brutal things that were done to us. And, I think the part of the human story of my account is the fact that I overcame that mistreatment and I resolved spiritually that I would not forget what happened, so that when I grew up, I could help liberate teleportation so that it could advantage everybody on our planet. But that's really another dimension of the story, is that one solitary individual overcame that brainwashing overcame just the trauma of being in the project per se, and I'm now able as an adult to integrate what happened and share it with others so that maybe we can do something with this teleportation technology. But I was able to reach six or seven of them, and their memories were essentially corroborative of mine, except, for example, when I'd have a discussion about what happened at a different defense contractor location off campus. Let's say they would talk about it one Saturday morning, and then the next Saturday they would not only forget what they had said, but forget that we had talked the previous Saturday. So I'm sorry to say that my co-participants, I think, are still victims of the brainwashing that was inflicted on us.
Do you believe the government has stopped the program, or might it be continuing in some form or fashion?
Well, we know that it was operational in 81 because that was the time that I, and it had actually been modeled into jump rooms where you were literally encased in something when you were located somewhere else in the universe, because that was the basis by which I did the two trips up to Mars. We also know it was still operational in 1991, fully 20 years after I was a child participant, because of the mishap that occurred in 71 when we were confused when we got to the state capitol grounds there in Santa Fe because the landscape had changed. And we asked some kids coming out of the roundhouse what year it was, and they told us it was 1991. So we know that it was still operational in 91 because we got home to 1971 mm-hmm. from a teleport at Sandia. We also know that it was still operational in different parts of the country in 2000 because that's when they had me jump. Excuse me. I have that wrong. The jump between Van Nuys and Los Alamos was in 1980. So the farthest I can take the timeline is to 91 when we got back from Sandia back
1991. Okay, we'll be back with final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Sci-Fi's 2012 show did very well in the ratings. That's the program that highlighted Richard C. Hoagland. And as a matter of fact, on our next Coast to Coast program, Whitley Strieber, Bob Gleason join us as we talk about 2012 and the implications for all of us from their perspective. When we come back, we'll take final phone calls with Andy on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie with our special guest tonight, Andy Bushago. Am I pronouncing your name right all night, by the way? Bushago, is it?
That's correct. It's Bushago, like Chicago.
I almost, when I was reading it the first time a couple weeks ago, I almost said Basiago. It looks that way.
Yes.
But it's not.
It's a Polish name.
Is it? It looks Italian.
Right. There's a district in Ravenna that's called Basiago, but it's actually, my dad was a Polish-American. It actually means, I believe, beekeeper in Polish, as derived from the medieval Latin word for
bees. Because as we know, there are no more bees anymore. I wonder, did you guys look at the bees in the future, find out what happened to the honeybees?
No, but strangely, I found a very elaborate statue of a bee with the head of a man that's located immediately west of the home plate plateau. That's one of the more interesting statues that I found up on Mars. So it's odd that we would find the statue of a bee with the head of a man at this time in Earth's history on one of our neighboring planets.
Okay, let's go to the phones. Final calls here. The wild card line, Eugene, Oregon, we go. Mike, go. Hi, Mike.
Yeah. Hi, George. Hi, Andrew. It sounds like you are coming across with a positive agenda. It doesn't sound to me like you have ulterior motives. And the way I look at the world, if people were allowed to be culture-free, ethical, independent, as opposed to the state of things now, the way we're degraded, poisoned, dumbed down, the world could be sustaining, even with what the population is currently, 6.5 billion people. I think about this a lot. I've thought about it a lot. And I don't think it's just a few or a few hundred megalomaniacal people destroying humanity and the planet. I think it's ancient, intergalactic, and it's also existing on and within this planet. Who or what is at the top or bottom of this unnecessary tragedy?
I don't know. That's a very broad question. You're almost asking me to resolve what the source of evil is in the world. I'd like to look at that equation in terms of asking ourselves what we can do to make a difference. I think we can all make a positive difference in the world, and all we have to do is try. When I first began my investigation and writing project regarding my childhood experiences in Project Pegasus. Naturally and understandably, I was disbelieved by my old friends in Los Angeles, my siblings, because in fact, in the case of my four brothers and sisters, my project experiences had been secreted from even from them by my father because they didn't have a need to know what we were involved in. But now I'm looking at a situation in which people are contacting me from all over the world to encourage me in my truth campaign. So I think just in my own experience over the last decade, I've been able to experience the fact that if you dedicate yourself to a positive goal and don't give up and don't give in, you can have a positive impact, and you'll start to find other human beings actually embracing what you're trying to accomplish, and you'll be lifted forward by the buoyancy of their spiritual commitment to what you're trying to achieve. That's already happened in my life, and I'm quite frankly profoundly moved by it. So I think rather than asking the big picture questions of what the source of evil is in the world or whether we've been undermined by broad cosmological patterns, we should try to work on the more intermediate level of what can we do to leave the world a better place during this brief moment in time when we're alive.
Was there anything in your travels, teleportation travels, Andy, that scared the living daylights out of you?
Oh, God. Not really. There was one of the paradoxes that was occurring that definitely left a profound sadness and impression on me. Because we did do a chronovisor probe. The first chronovisor probe in Morristown, we went to the time of the dinosaurs, and I saw some immense dinosaurs, but I wasn't frightened by them. They were long-necked dinosaurs that were chomping on grass. One of the things that really horrified me and left a sense of profound sadness is they sent me to New York City around 1900. To the Five Points neighborhood of New York City that's depicted in that famous movie, Gangs of New York. And I found myself trapped in a squalid tenement for 3 days. The paradox that was occurring is when we would be placed in the holograms, the program administrators believed that we were only in for several minutes. And I was finding that once we were immersed in the hologram, we were frequently in there for days. And so one of the more terrifying aspects as a child was just fending for myself for several days while we were in these virtual realities that we had been immersed in. And in that case, I was in a tenement that was so squalid I could hardly even stand the smell of it. It was just a miserable place to be. And so I think I have a special insight now at this point to really how miserable living conditions were in certain periods of history and how lucky we are to enjoy a much better time to be alive.
We are very lucky, aren't we?
Yes. Let's go.
Mm-hmm. We'll go to Brian in Oregon City, Oregon. Go ahead, Brian. You're up with us.
Hey, George. I have to be frank. I really don't believe your guest. I want to know why, if we have all this wonderful time travel technology that's so fantastic, why 9/11 wasn't, undone?
Well, that's a good question, and I respect the fact that you don't believe me, and all I can do is simply speak my truth and sort of let the chips fall where they may. I am telling the truth. 9/11 hasn't come up yet in tonight's broadcast, and so let me raise it. Project Pegasus recovered prior information about 9/11. I witnessed it personally. What it had was an 18 to 20-second film loop of one of the planes hitting one of the Twin Towers. I saw that that we were called down to the Aerojet Corporation facility that formerly existed at the corner of Bullock Avenue and Leroy Place in Socorro, New Mexico. Now, the reason I believe that 9/11 wasn't stopped as a result of the Defense Department having prior knowledge of it is it may have been a practical reason, but that was just an intelligence finding that got dropped into files, and then people like Don Rumsfeld and others who were then in government when 9/11 occurred simply weren't even thinking about what had previously been detected by Project Pegasus about that horrific event. But in general terms, one of the reasons they decided to not change future events was because if it's a big event like 9/11 that affects a lot of people, if you prevent it from happening, you then divert the course of all of the events that occur after that event. And if you're involved in an intelligence gathering project, the purpose of which is to discern information from the past and future that you can act upon. The paradox is you can't change a future event and not diminish the quality of the intelligence database that you're gathering for events after that big event. So I believe that relative to 9/11, that the U.S. government knew that it was coming. We have evidence of that made in statements by the president, by Condoleezza Rice, and others. We have the president's statement that he saw the first plane hit the first tower. We have Condoleezza Rice's advisement to former Mayor Brown of San Francisco not to fly that day. We have the moving of Don Rumsfeld's desk to the other side of the Pentagon and other clues that they were preparing for that event on that day. I believe the reason that they let it happen is not because they're evil people, but simply because it's in the nature of quantum access that if you stop or prevent a major event in the future, you essentially diminish the intelligence value of the intelligence database you've gathered for all events occurring after that mega event. And that's what I believe happened on 9/11.
Okay, thank you. Calvin, Cincinnati, Ohio, first-time caller. Hi, Calvin, go ahead.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Andy, how are you today?
Good, good.
I've been listening to you all night. A lot of the stuff that you've been talking about, very interesting. One of the questions I had was, what's the name of your book that's coming out, and when will it be out?
The title is Once Upon a Time in Time's Stream, My Adventures in Project Pegasus at the Dawn of the Time-Space Age, and it should be out by the late spring. I have 225 passages written, and I simply have to find some quiet hours away from my professional activities as a trial lawyer to sit down and knock out the final manuscript.
Well, very good. Let's go next to Springfield, Missouri. David, east of the Rockies. Hey, David, go ahead.
Yes, sir. George, Andrew, it's a true pleasure. And I would just like to say, Andrew, my question is, I got to say, I'm a bit of a skeptic. What you're saying really intrigues me. But I've got to ask, is there something that you can tell the coast-to-coast listeners to reaffirm, you know, let's say, can you tell us who the next president is going to be? Can you tell us something that's going to happen in the near future, in which case where the listeners will say just wow and be astounded, you know, blow your mind, wow, you know, that he's true?
Right. Well, let me answer that specific question. It came up earlier, and I just want to emphasize that there were really only a couple things about the future that I was able to glean simply by having the opportunity to sit around the dinner table, the lunch table, in a social context when I was a child participant on the project.
And again, how old were you again, Andy, when this was happening?
Well, I first teleported to Santa Fe with my father in the 1967-68 time frame, and we know that because when we met with Dr. Agnew at the Los Alamos Labs, he asked my dad how old I was, and we both said simultaneously 6. But then after a couple more experiences where he took me to project locations, I wasn't officially enrolled in the project until the fall of 1969 when I was 7 going on 8. And then I was in the project for 3 years to around age 11. And then my project experiences ended as an official matter, and then we moved to Southern California when I was 11. But let me just say that there were only a couple of events in the future that I was able to identify retrospectively from 40 years out, you know, as an adult, that I know to an historical certainty that the project had knowledge about. And those were, I mentioned the particular presidencies. There was also a discussion of the advent of AIDS, in other words, a sexually transmitted disease that could be lethal. There was a discussion about the internet, I know, that took place at the dinner table, and somebody was trying to explain to my dad what it was, and then he got up from the table and said, well, this .com thing still bothers me. I mean, how do we know that doesn't mean that the commies have taken over by then? So they clearly had a knowledge of the advent of the internet, and just a few events like that, 9/11 I mentioned. But it wasn't as if I was being briefed all the time on what the future held. So the only reason I'm able to historically look back and say, well, these are the presidents they knew about, is because their names came up. And I don't have any discrete memory of somebody after President Obama being president. But I would say that prior to President Obama's election, I did share with some of my research associates including Alfred Weber, the fact that President Obama would be our next president, because when I met him when we were college students, one of his close associates said that I should be nice to him because he was going to be president of the United States someday. So, and I've correlated that to this whole issue of quantum access. Generally, let me say this, and that is that to skeptics, I would say this. Look, between what the American public has been told the U.S. government has achieved and between and what it has really achieved falls everything that falls under the umbrella of official state secrecy. So when somebody like myself comes forward and shares what occurs in that part of the graph between the between the known and what is unknowable because it remains secret, are all the secrets. And so all I can do is just tell the truth. Hopefully people will see that I am telling the truth. But I can't convince those who would choose not to believe my veracity or the factuality of what I'm articulating. I'm just trying to share what happened so that people can derive an understanding of the fact that 40 years ago in America's defense labs, the time-space age emerged and very few people were told about it.
Very few. Couple minutes to go. Rebecca in Huffman, Texas. Hey, Rebecca, go ahead.
Great show, as always. I was wondering if the television show Fringe has any basis to Andy's research.
Well, I've heard some reports about elements of Fringe mirroring some of my allegations or some of the facts of my case, and that could just be because these ideas are in the ether right now, like a lot of scientific and parascientific premises. I also did present my story to a number of top television networks back in 2007, and I hope that information from my own account hasn't formed the basis of Fringe or other science fiction shows. So I think that's a question that I wouldn't hazard to try to answer at this time. I have heard that Fringe has described certain things that are very similar to my experiences, and all I can say is I've already presented my account to several leading television networks, and I hope that my facts haven't formed the basis of several of today's.
Maybe the government is putting shows out like Fringe to condition us for the release of this information.
Well, they knew even going back 40 years ago that I was going to be launching this truth campaign. In fact, I was persona non grata in the project roughly from the summer of 1971 until I was terminated from the project after the summer of 72. Of course, we had pre-experienced the summer of 73 by accessing it from November of 71. But they've known for 40 years that my personal destiny would involve bringing this information to the attention of the American people. And so it's quite possible that if mass media is being used in that way, that these ideas are now being dropped into science fiction dramas on television to confuse the public about the historicity of my claims.
Right. Even basic cartoons now have got, Earth people going to, like, alien planets, and we're scaring the aliens. So, they're even conditioning the toddlers of this world right now, is what I'm seeing.
Well, apropos of that, all I can say is I'm I'm not involved in any kind of release of this information on behalf of any U.S. government agency. I've been very transparent about the different branches of the intelligence community that I've been attached to in the past as a result of my project experiences. This is an independent whistleblower campaign, and it's an authentic expression of my life experience and the political act that I've undertaken, and I'm not involved in any kind of release of this information on behalf of the government, although I do believe that the government should take responsibility for releasing this information.
Have you ever been accused of being a disinformation specialist or anything like that?
Every day, George. I mean, it's so ironic because, I find myself being able to have the privilege of first being in this project and then also hopefully my truth campaign will succeed and we'll be able to use teleportation to literally revolutionize transportation on our planet, particularly if President Obama does the right thing and declassifies it during his administration so we can launch that project as soon as possible. But yes, every day I receive emails on either my Mars findings or my Pegasus revelations stating that I'm a disinformation agent, and I really respond that, hey, I'm flattered because my information must be so seamless that you don't trust it. But I am not a disinformation agent. In fact, in my book, I'm going to provide copious factual analysis that I think will convince the fair-minded reader that I'm telling the truth.
Okay, very good indeed. Well, All I know is that you bring together a very fascinating, fascinating story, Andy, and stay in touch with us in the future, okay?
I will. It's been a privilege to be on your show. You know, I've been a listener, I think, since the very earliest days with Art, and I never thought I would be on. It certainly wasn't something that I visited from the past, back when I was time traveling on Project Pegasus, and it's just been an honor and a privilege to be with you during tonight's show, and hopefully we'll have the impact and be able to get this teleportation capability, wrestle it out of the grips of the defense technical community and use it to advantage everybody on our planet.
Well, you definitely keep in touch with us, Andy. I appreciate you being on the show. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.